As long as you're nice enough to give me this interview, I'm going to make a confession to you.
What?
That tape we did last time.
Yes.
It was destroyed. Or lost or something.
Was it really?
Yeah, it really was. I'm going to, you know, funny things happen at this station, so.
Oh, I'm so glad.
I'm going to ask you to do the whole thing over again.
Oh, good.
In the mood to tell the story of your life.
Sure, anytime. Oh, it wasn't really destroyed or lost? Oh, that's great, because I thought afterwards, Richard, I thought, well, I suppose there have been duller interviews, but I was really so low. I mean, I was perfectly happy, but for some reason, I was in a low conversational mood and all that malarkey, you know. And I don't remember. I know I talked about a lot of pretentious things, and don't let me do it this time, please. Keep me on the track, will you?
Hey, I just think that your mind wandered a little. We got to talking about a number of things that really weren't in the format. Anyway, and I don't remember that much of it, so it's going to be interesting for me. As I recall, I was dead drunk, yeah.
I was on my way, certainly.
Yeah. Well, as I recall, your grandfather was a watchman in one of the studios?
Yes.
You take it from there.
Yes, my grandfather. I can go back farther, if you prefer.
Why don't you go right back to the beginning and tell them what your real name is?
That's far back. My real name is Herbert Alonzo McAllister, Jr. I was born in Los Angeles, 1923, April 17th. I came of, quote, good stock. I have very nice, warm, good parents. But what I started to tell you about my grandparents... you ask about my grandfather, who was a night watchman and a studio guard all during the Depression years. Before that, though, before he came to California, in Illinois and in Arkansas, my grandparents had motion picture houses and the old opera house. And my grandmother was obviously touched with the madness of showbiz, because it was her doing that got them west to California. My grandfather, in those days, was in the stave mill business, and he operated mills in Arkansas at that time.
Well, pardon me, what's a stave mill?
Well, on barrels, you know, the things that contain the barrel, the wood that has to be formed for the shape of the bell. That's the world of the stave mill. But they came to, they sold their theaters. I don't know if I mentioned this to you or not, but I love it, and it never happened to me, so that's why I love it. My mother had a theater named for her, the Madeline, and I don't know whether it still exists. It was in a town called Newport, Arkansas, and when I once drove through there, I went in search of the Madeline Theater in Newport. And it was still there then, but this is, you know, 30 years ago. Whether
Scudahoo, Scudahay was playing.
Oh, I wish it had been. I think it was bowling night or something. I don't know. But, no, as a matter of fact, I was in Newport when I was still doing extra work. So it was probably Norma Shearer and Leslie Howard in Romeo and Juliet, or Eddie Robinson in Confessions of a Nazi Spy, or Kay Francis in... what was that wonderful thing she did with that I worked as an extra in, as a matter of fact? Always in My Heart. Do you remember that? One of the lesser Warner epics.
Is it generally known, or was it when you became Lon McAllister movie star, that you had done extra work?
Oh, sure. There was, as a matter of fact, the very first release, you won't remember this, but my so-called big break was in something called Stage Door Canteen. And the first one to mention it was Hedda Hopper. And Hedda said, the grandson of the RKO studio gate man has been chosen to play Romeo opposite Catherine Cornell's Juliet in Saul Lesser's Stage Door Canteen. And I was still in college. I was, I guess I was a freshman or a sophomore. No, sophomore. And I read about it in the paper, and I didn't know until someone called and told me that I had the part. And, of course, that was the thing that changed my life. But I got off the point. Hedda Hopper also went on to say that I'd been an extra for a long time in the business, which gave hope to all the other extras. So it was from the very beginning a fact.
When you auditioned for that part, did you know it was going to be a big part, or a part that would make a name?
I didn't know. I don't think, no, I didn't really. I knew that it was a good part. This was during the war years, and my college was Chapman College. And our campus was taken over by the Navy for Navy programs, and we were moved out to Whittier College, President's alma mater. And we shared the campus with the Whittier students and the Chapman students. And all during that period, I was doing a lot of extra work. And by that time, I had graduated to bit parts, you know, the elevator operator or the newsboy or the copy boy. And I was doing a tremendous amount of radio work. That was a peak period for the radio programs on the West Coast. So I was able to go to college. I couldn't go to UCLA at that time because they used to have a program stipulation that one could not be absent more than a certain number of days. And I thought, well, hell, I have to work if I'm going to go to college. And so I couldn't go to UCLA. This is drum beating, but I was my class valedictorian, and I thought, well, I should be able to go to UCLA. You know, that seems logical. Well, I was accepted. And when I learned the problems of, I don't remember what it was now, but if you were absent from a particular class, you know, more than five times in a semester, it would automatically lower your grade. And I thought, well, the hell with that, I can't do that. So I went to a small school called Chapman College. And anyway, it was at that time that the stories about Stage Door Canteen began circulating among all the would-be actors, the would-be stars. Mr. Lesser was going to do a picture presenting all of the great Broadway performers who contributed their time and effort to the canteens, to the Stage Door Canteen particularly, the one in New York. And the plot, written by Delmer Davis, the story was concerned primarily with four young soldiers and the four young women they meet at the canteen. And all we knew about it in the pre-publicity, the advance publicity on the picture, was that they were very good parts and they were all going to be played by unknowns. And I knew nothing about anything except I wanted desperately to get on an interview. Everyone else in town was being called out for an interview. And I couldn't get it for some reason. I don't know why. And I finally called the studio and I said, I'd like to come out and audition for your movie. And just, I don't know, you know, luck along the way. They said, well, fine, come out today if you want. We're seeing people. It's the end of the run and we're still looking. So I went out and as I say, luck has so much to do with all of our lives. I was in the casting director's office, not making much of an impression, and Frank Borzage walked in. And Frank Borzage was the director, and I was introduced to him. And because I am not a tremendously good, but certainly a student of motion picture history, I was thrilled to meet him. Really was, because things he had done, I loved. You know, he had done, of course, Seventh Heaven, and I was always mad about Janet Gaynor. And so, whatever it was, Mr. Borzage liked me, and he said, bring the kid in. And you know, it sounds like something out of Once in a Lifetime. Bring the kid in to Saul. No, he was a sweet, wonderful man, and he said, "Bring this young fellow in and let Saul see him." That was Mr. Lesser. So they did, and I met them, and they asked me to read, which I did. And curiously enough, I had never tested. As long as I'd been working in pictures, I'd never got to the point where someone thought it was worth wasting film to make a test. So this time they did, and my very first test, and We did it over at RKO, and my grandfather was on duty, as a matter of fact, when I made the test. And I remember, you know, of course you remember these things vividly. I remember feeling miserable and thinking, my God, here I've been in the business since I was 13, and I was now 19. And I hadn't really done anything except got established as a, I don't know, as one of the young Hollywood kids available for one-liners, but never to be trusted with a part, probably. You know, I don't know. I say that, and I don't know that that's really true, but I do know that all those years, no one ever saw any potential in me, you know, other than just a fill up the background fella kind of thing. And I wanted it. My God, I wanted it. And anyway, getting back to the day of the test, I remember I saw Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers walking along one of the streets. And I thought, oh, God.
Walking? They were walking?
They weren't dancing. They were just well, you know, when they walked, quote, they danced. But I thought, gee, how exciting, whether I get it or not. I had never worked at RKO in all those extra days. I always tried, because I thought, gee, it'd be fun to be where my grandfather's working. Never could get a job. I worked across the street at Paramount. I worked all around, but never at dear old RKO. Well, anyway, that was my one time at RKO. There were Astaire and Rogers walking along, dancing along. And I did the test. I was the last one to test. And it was one of those things where they called, you know, makeup at 8 o'clock. And I think we finally shot it at 5 in the afternoon. I was called in about 4:45, and everybody that was still testing had been tested. And I was the last one. I'd learned later, this is what Mr. Borzigi told me. He directed the test. I did it with a beautiful girl named Marjorie Reardon, who played the part. And it was just, well, to begin with, it was the first time I'd ever acted a scene in front of a camera that was running. And everything went well. We did it. As I recall, we did the master shot in one take. Then we did, I think there was one close two shot and a couple of over the shoulders. And we were through by about 5:45, I think. I know I was out of there by 6, because I remember seeing my grandfather. And that was it. I went back to school, and I didn't hear anything until I read the article, or rather someone read the article in Hedda Hopper's column and called and told me. And I rushed down and bought the paper and saw it. And I was rooming with three guys at Chapman in the dorm. And we had a big party that night. Four of us went out on the town. I think we had, I don't know, double scoops, you know, at the local, I think it was called the Spinning Wheel in Whittier. I don't know if it's still there or not. Anyway, that was that's when I first learned about it. Then, of course, I had to drop out of school and to do the movie, because we went on location to New York and worked with all of the great stars on Broadway, which was a rare experience. And I look back on that and I think, my God, how fortunate to be in the presence and also to work with Miss Cornell and the Lunts and Helen Hayes and, oh, just everyone. You know, Katharine Hepburn, Gracie Fields, Ethel Merman. All, you know, you look back and you think, good Lord, whatever leads up to a moment in life when you suddenly get a break, you couldn't have asked for a better break, because everybody was going to go see the picture out of patriotism or curiosity. And the four unknown people, the four fellas and the four girls, were just, couldn't have been presented in a better way to all of the world, you know, because I think everyone went to see that kind of a picture. And that was the beginning. That was the change.
Did you get a contract from that?
Yes, I did, but I also received my draft notice. And I thought I was going into the service right away. And when the picture was previewed, Mr. Lesser put me under contract. And he said, 20th Century Fox is doing a movie called Home in Indiana, and they want you to be in it. They liked what they saw in Canteen. and you'd play a farmer. And I said, Mr. Lesser, I don't know anything about being a farmer. I, you know, Los Angeles boy, never been on a farm except to visit my second and third cousins up in Washington or on the Sacramento. And he said, well, go over and talk to Henry Hathaway, who's directing it. So I did. I talked to Mr. Hathaway, and I'd heard he was a very difficult, mean director. And went over and talked to him. He couldn't have been nicer. And he said, we'd like you to do the picture. We've got a couple of new girls. We're going to get a couple of unknown girls to play the feminine leads. And Walter Brennan is going to be in it. And I loved Walter because I had worked in several pictures as an extra or as a bit player with Walter. And he'd always been an extremely nice, very kind man and an actor that I enjoyed being with. And I thought, gee, that sounds great. So, anyway, the studio got a deferment, and I did Home in Indiana, and did all sorts of things that I'd never thought of doing, driving sulkies and races on the various tracks in Kentucky and Ohio, and we never did shoot any of Home in Indiana in Indiana. We shot a lot of it out at Malibu Lake. But did the picture, and then I went into the Army immediately after that, and my contract, which was your question, and I'm far off of it, my contract then was in abeyance until I returned 2 years later with Mr. Lesser.
When you were under contract, did you ask them to buy any properties for you? Were there roles that they had that you wanted very much?
Somewhere along the line, someone said, oh, you should do all of the things that Richard Barthelmess did. So I started seeing all the films that Mr. Barthelmess had made. And it came, well, I suppose, fairly close to doing it. I say the studio came close to getting Tolerable David. They thought about doing a remake of that. And I loved Barthelmess and all of the things that he did. But I don't remember now what happened. We didn't do it. There was one property that I kept, that I wanted to do desperately, and it was a Thornton Wilder book called Heaven's My Destination. And now, 1971, I read that Garson Kanin and Ruth Gordon, Mrs. Kanin, are doing a script of it, and I suppose it's going to be made as a movie. By now, of course, I could play the father, you know, or there, I mean, not that there's a father part, but I no longer would be the young Bible salesman.
Richard Cromwell did a version of Tolerable David, I think. It wasn't very successful, as I remember.
I never saw it, and, I never met Richard Cromwell. I remember once sitting in a restaurant. You know, there used to be a restaurant at the end of the pier at Malibu. And one night I was there. I used to walk down there and have dinner when I really felt flush, you know. And I saw him sitting at a table. And I didn't know him, and I'm never any good at that. You know, I hate to go backstage and tell people how much I like them, and I well, in those days anyway, I wouldn't go over and say, hi, my name is McAllister, and I'm a great fan of yours. I was never any good at that, and so I missed my chance, and I'm sorry, you know. Now I'm much more brazen, you know. I'll go up to almost anyone. I mean, if I really want.
I have I think it's 1940 Academy Players Directory with a picture of you in it as Buddy McAllister. Who changed the name?
I was, let's see, 1940. I thought I was Bud McAllister by then. I went through a series of names. When I first started in pictures in 36, I guess it was. And, you know, it's terrible. I'm never sure now whether it was 35 or 36. I was Buddy McAllister, and I sang in a boys' choir. And when I went in to high school, I thought, well, you can't be called Buddy. So I cut it to Bud. And when we started work on Cesar Canteen, I was still Bud McAllister. And after we finished it, when they were getting ready for the big publicity campaign, Mr. Lesser said, I don't think Bud McAllister is a very good name. And, you know, if someone says, I don't think Richard Lamparsky is a very good name, it stops you for a minute. And he said, I mean, I like your name, Bud, but it's not good for movies. I said, well, what do you think I should be, Mr. Lesser? And he said, well, you think about it. Well, I thought, I never liked the name Herbert, Herbie, Bert. The only one I ever liked was Herbert Marshall because he was called Bart. So I thought, Bart McAllister. I thought, no, that doesn't sound like me. That sounds like a Dashiell Hammett character, you know, or anyway, came down to Alonzo. I thought, well, my father was called Lon, and Lon was an unusual enough name in that there had only been the Cheneys, Mr. Senior and Junior, and or were there, maybe there were some other Lons. Anyway, they were the only ones I thought of at the time. And I mentioned it to Mr. Lesser and to Frank Borzaghi, and they both said, yeah, Lon McAllister, that sounds like it might be all right. You know, it's funny. I wish now I had shortened my last name. Because I when you get to the point where you see your name on a marquee, and you talk to theater managers, and having come from a family of people who'd been involved in changing the marquee, and I used to do that when I was in college. I had one of my roommates used to change the marquee up at the old KNX on Sunset, and I oftentimes would we'd be doing homework, and I'd go with him to change the marquee so that it would go from what was it, the Silver Theater with Conrad Nagel to what was the other show, the Gulf Screen. Is it the Screen Actors Guild? No, not the Screen Actors. What the heck was that show? Sunday afternoon, the Gulf Screen Guild Players, do you remember? You have no recollection? Well, you weren't around in those days. I was. Anyway, I often thought, I wish I had shortened my name. McAllister is, you know, is really not much of a theatrical name. I don't know what I would have cut it to, you know. Someone says, obviously, McCall, you know, or I don't know. I never did.
Now, was there a particular point at which you decided you really didn't want to do pictures anymore, or?
Is that a leading question? Hmm? Well, it goes back long, long before I had any success at all. When I was still in high school, I've got it around here somewhere. I should drag it out and show it to you. In my high school annual, one of my ambitions as a 16-year-old was to retire from whatever I was doing at the age of 30. And those born under the sign of Aries are stubborn, as you probably know by now. And I don't know how much of it was stubbornness or how much of it was luck or how much of it was intelligent thinking on my part. Because by the time I reached 29... I was making pictures that were less than first class, and they weren't enjoyable to make. I made them because the money was good. But in looking back, if I were at the very top, I probably wouldn't have quit at 29. But I was at a point, fate put me at a point, where I was making pictures I really didn't like. And I thought, the time has come, Mac, to move on. And so I quit at 29 instead of waiting until I was 30, got on the freighter and went off to South America. I've never regretted it. As I say, if I had just made another Home in Indiana, which was a spectacular success as a picture and helped everyone in it, I might not have been quite so adamant in leaving Hollywood. Of course, you never can leave your hometown. I was born here. My feelings about the town are so much more involved, I think. Not necessarily more personal, but all of my formative years were here, you know, and my feelings about Hollywood are, I feel about it now the way one feels about their parents as they grow old. You want to take care of them.
Well, now, why don't you must tell them what you're doing now, how you spend your time.
What I'm doing now, it sounds so nothing, and it's so good. I lead a happy, anonymous, creative, interesting for me life. Every day, I have a hell of a good time. I really do. All the simple pleasures that you never know as a kid. You may suspect in adolescence, and if you're lucky, in your young adult life, you begin to suspect that there's that good a life available. When I worked in pictures, I did the best I could. It wasn't very good, really, but I did the best that I could. And looking back, even those pictures that I talk about at the last couple of years, which were really awful, I still tried. I really did. You know, it sounds Pollyanna, but I really tried to give whatever was my best at that time.
WBAI, New York.
I think it's interesting that of all the things you list about the pleasantness of your life today, that one of them that sounded like a great luxury coming from you was being unknown, anonymous, I think was the word you used.
Anonymous, yes. Anonymity has always appealed to me. And I think it does to most actors. I think when you find yourself lucky enough to be at a point where people point at you in the market or turn and stare at you on the street, you know you're successful in a way. But until it happens to you, you don't really know what... I'm sure many people have told you this on your interviews, but you don't really know what it is to lose the safety of privacy. And it was part of the business, and I didn't mind losing it. I mean, I loved it. I loved having people look at me when I was in the business. But it reaches a point where you realize that you lose the opportunity to experience so many of the simple pleasures. And that sounds silly, I suppose, but the joy of almost any everyday experience is monumental as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I love to go to things that most people would find a terrible bore. I love to go to end of the month sales, you know, at Bullock's or Robinson's here in town. Or I love to so many things that sound ridiculous. I love to go. I live alone, so I do all my own shopping. I love to go to the supermarkets, and I love to go to the specialty shops, and I sound like I'm a great Hetty Green collector, but I don't mean that. But it's just the I love in traveling. You know, as you know, I have a motorhome, and I love to pull into a campground or into a station and just be a rather aging, white-haired traveler. You know, kind of a road company John Steinbeck, because the dog's always with me, like Mr. Steinbeck's Charlie. I've got Carlotta; she's always with me, and. All of those wonderful exchanges between human beings that you don't get when you're a star, certainly. God knows you don't. You don't have the opportunity, and if you did, you probably wouldn't know how to cope with it, unless you had been in it all your life.
I think I've got just enough time left to say goodbye to you and tell you something that I didn't think I've ever told you in all the times we've dished here in your house. That of all the people, you know, I keep all the mail that, what little I get, I keep all of it from all the books and all the programs I've done. And I was going over, you know, the list of the people would send me, and some of them will ask about two or three people, and some will go on for two or three pages, typewritten, believe it or not, that I sort of did a poll, I guess because, you know, I'm thinking of doing another book, and you're number four of all the people that people ask about.
Well, I thank you very much. That's very nice to hear. Really, that's very, very kind of you, Richard. I the obvious question is, who is number one, two, and three? And I'm happy to be part of that group. Thank you.
That's well, it's your fans you have to thank. But number one is Deanna Durbin.
Oh.
And number three is Susanna Foster. And for the life of me, I can't tell you who number two is. But you're number four.
And Deanna is number one. How wonderful. I'm going to write and tell her. You know, I correspond with her quite frequently. Not quite frequently, frequently. I stayed with her when I was in Paris. And... she's a wonderful woman, and she looks... I worked extra in a lot of her pictures, by the way. And she's happily married, as you know. And I think she has a married daughter living in California now. I don't know if you've heard any of this or not. And her son, gosh, he must be in his late teens by now, because when I was there, it was 11, 11 years ago was the last time. But we still exchange cards at Christmas time, and occasionally during the year I'll send her something that I think will amuse her.
Well, I didn't know that. So I'll run over for just a minute and ask you, how does she feel about her career now?
I think she has no desire, of course, no desire to return. I think when she left Universal in 48 or 49, whenever it was, it must have been a serious moment for her to make that kind of a break. And fortunately, she married a man that is seems to me, in the brief time that I knew him, to be a kind, extraordinarily intelligent, nice man. And her life is, I think, a very complete life. She has a beautiful farm. They have a beautiful farm in the country, and an apartment in Paris on the Île Saint-Louis, where I stayed. And she has the best of, I hope for her, the best of both worlds. I think her parents, or I'm not sure whether they're both still living now, but they were living here in Hollywood. And as you know, Deanna, or Edna May, as I jokingly call her, because that's her name, you know, is a Canadian girl. And I think because of that, she occasionally comes back to the States. It's always happened, though, that I've been out of the country when she's come back, and I haven't seen her since 59. But she has a good life in Paris. By the way, let me say this. She looks, or she did then, and she sent me a picture, just a little quick snap, that Charles, her husband, took of her when they were traveling from Paris down to Cannes, I think. And it was, you know, just sunlight next to a road sign. I don't remember now what it was, but it was funny. But she looked beautiful. And all these stories that you hear about the fat prima donna are a bunch of malarkey, because she, to begin with, she always had great legs, and I don't know if people ever remember that, but working extra on that certain age and first love, I was extremely aware of the physical attributes of Deanna Durbin. And she had I shouldn't say that, sounds strange, but she had a beautiful young body. And when I saw her in 59... I keep saying 59, it was 58. Forgive me. And stayed with her. She looked tremendous, just beautiful. And she was maybe, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 pounds overweight. And that's not much, because I think Deanna Edna May must be 5'6", 5'7". And she looked just beautiful. And I watched her walk away at one point on the street in Paris. And she still has those great legs. And I was so pleased to see that. And she's a dear person, really. She practices, by the way. She likes to keep musically involved, but no interest in a career. She told me that they were always trying to get her to Vegas. I guess they always would, you know. And she had seen Judy Garland when Judy was in Paris. And she said, I can't quote her, of course, but she said, "The life I have chosen for myself is right for me. And I love and admire Judy for what she has done with her career, but I wouldn't want it for myself." She really was and is, I'm sure, a very happily married Parisian, Canadian girl out of Los Angeles to Paris.
We can't end on a nicer note than that. I won't even try to. I've been talking today with Lon McAllister. If I said Venice, it would sound more glamorous. I'll say Venice by the Sea, though. That would be more accurate. Venice by the Sea in California. That's right near Santa Monica.
You know what they call Venice? Venice, according to the Los Angeles Times, is the last poor beach.
Well, that's where we are anyway. And I was with Lon McAllister today. This is Richard Lamparsky. Thank you for listening. Good night.
Good night.